No, Kyle, no, don't shake hands with that guy. He looks sick. Oh, you stupid idiot. Now go find Betsy's hand sanitizer. No, don't pick up the leftover sandwich from the marketing meeting. No. Ugh.
Kyone?
Hold on, I think Greg is talking to me. What?
Ever since I've been sharing cubicle space with you, I've noticed that you talk to yourself, but today seems extra weird.
Oh, today I'm using Pluperfect auto address. That's when I talked to myself in the past. I was talking to the me that hadn't gotten a cold yet.
What good does that do?
You know, I'm not exactly sure. Maybe it reprograms me so that I'm less likely to make similar mistakes in the future. No, you can't combine whiskey, Ambien, and NyQuil. You're gonna wind up sleeping with that icky French horn player.
French, who plays that French horn? I don't know any such person.
Sorry, I was talking to myself in 2004. It's a long story.
Maybe we should get back to work.
That's a good idea. I'm swamped anyway. No, Kyone, you can't punch Sandra Bernhardt in the face just because of the way she hangs our toilet paper roll. Yeah, but I can't be that person anymore. Not even for her. We hate the hobbits. Kill them in their sleep.
Okay, that's it. Way too much talking to yourself.
Oh. How much of that was actually audible?
All of it?
We all talk to ourselves, right? It might be the most universal condition that we nevertheless look down on. Today on the show, a novelist and a clinician talk to each other about talking to ourselves. And now he talked to himself this morning, but he wasn't listening. Colin McEnroe.
You know, earlier today I asked about this on Facebook. I asked people whether they talk to themselves, whether they talk aloud to themselves, whether it's an inner monologue or dialogue with themselves. And I think nobody claimed they didn't talk to themselves. And it is an odd thing because we have this strange prejudice that it's pathological somehow. There's something pathological if you're standing there talking to yourself. There's something wrong with you, and that you're doing it maybe because you don't think anybody's aware that you're doing it. You don't think anybody's within earshot, and so we pathologize this. But I think it's also universal. I mean, how could something that universal be a pathology? So that's some of what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to talk about it, interestingly, from a literary perspective. But we're also going to talk about it from the well. Actually, there turns out to be a fair amount of research into the question of what happens when people talk to themselves. What are our inner monologues, and can they be adjusted? All right, so you see this everywhere. In fact, as we were getting ready for the show today, and by the way, as we go along today, if you have something that you want to contribute to, some way you want to contribute to this conversation, call us at 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. I was thinking of a moment in Lord of the Rings. Okay, here's one of the most universally devoured pieces of literature. In Lord of the Rings, Gandalf talks to himself, and I think it's Aragorn says, you know, are you speaking in riddles? And he says, no, I was talking aloud to myself, a habit of the old. They choose the wisest person present to speak to. The long explanations needed by the young are wearying. And then he laughs. Of course, the more pathological version of self-talk in that particular work of literature turns up in Gollum, who does conduct long, schizoid conversations between alternate versions of himself. But this notion of talking to ourselves, it's everywhere. The inner monologue is given a different shape in the new movie Birdman, where the actor played by Michael Keaton is addressed by the character he once played. But we're going to talk about a different work of literature as we begin today, and we are very excited to have with us is we're very excited to have Andres Neumann. He is one of the really exciting novelists in the world today, and his fourth novel, Traveler of the Century, won all kinds of awards. Right now he's got Talking to Ourselves, a new novel, in which, in fact, this whole notion of self-talk is explored in three different modes, I guess. The inner silent dialogue that we have with ourselves, the talking aloud that some of us do, and journaling, writing in a diary. There are three characters in this novel. Each of them is experiencing or on the cusp of tremendous loss, and each of them is using one of those modes of talking to the self as a way of getting through this transition into loss. So, Andres Neumann, first of all, welcome to our show.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me.
Hello
from Spain, by the way.
All right. Well, it's lovely to have somebody from Spain here on a rainy day in America.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but it's almost raining here as well.
Okay. You could have let me dream. All right. So, first of all, did you make a conscious choice as you decided to tell this tale that you would tell it through three different modes of talking to oneself?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It was at the very heart of the writing. I felt I needed more than one point of view. Since it's a novel about a deep and intimate conflict, I felt that a conflict needs to be contemplated from different perspectives. So it was very important, the counterpoint and the changes of mind. Although the protagonist is Elena, who is the caretaker, you say in English?
Mm-hmm.
She's the caretaker. It's a novel mainly on what a caretaker feels when taking care of someone else. But I needed as well the two more points of view, the one who knows everything, the ill one, and the one who doesn't know anything because he's not told the truth, who is the little boy. So this counterpoint is at the heart of a conflict.
In this book, it's a very short book. It has almost everything in the world in it. It's kind of amazing that way. It has love and sex and loss and death and illness and this very interesting question of how we process our world. And as you read this book and as you read the inner thoughts of the little boy, the diary entries of the wife and caretaker, and the spoken out loud soliloquies of the father who is sick, it does seem as though you start to realize that we all do talk to ourselves in one way or another. We wouldn't be able to process reality if we didn't talk to ourselves. Do you talk to yourself, and do you speak aloud to yourself?
Well, I'm doing it right now.
No, you're speaking to me right now.
Because I think we all do that, and I would say it's a sign of healthiness rather than madness. I think there's been some unfair mockeries about people who talk to themselves. As long as you take control of the process, it can be very liberating and fascinating too. I think that being aware that we contradict ourselves, and we do usually have more than one opinion or perspective about one same thing, that there's a constant debate inside our minds. And I think this research becomes extremely useful for fiction or for grief. And on the other hand, what you mentioned before, it's really important in the book. You get not only three points of view from a classical perspective, but as well three modes of speech. That's what you mentioned at the beginning. And I thought it could be interesting to explore the three ways we do actually have to talk to ourselves. One is thinking, the second one is talking aloud, and the third one is writing. I think there are no more ways to do so. And I think that a reader or a writer, what they actually do is showing that we're able to identify ourselves with someone else and exploring our different selves. That's what fiction is about.
You know, there are a couple of moments in the novel that I think make the same point. And there every page of the novel makes some version of this point. There's one point at which the little boy, Lito, he's thinking about talking to his mother, the conversations he has on the phone with his mother while he's on this road trip. And he says, she asks if I miss her. I do, but not when she asks me. And then later, much later in the book, Elena, the mother who is asking that question, she's a writer. She's writing in her journal, and she talks about the way it's a misconception that pain is at its worst when you're going through it. That in fact, pain is experienced most fully at some subsequent point. And I think that the same argument is being made in both places, which is that we use self-talk, the process of telling ourselves the stories of what's happened, to experience all of those emotions, which are difficult to experience in the moment.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think art, I would say, I dare to say that art is a resource to be aware of what you felt or actually experienced. We not simply write what we felt, but we as well write or read in order to feel or to realize we have been feeling pleasure or pain or whatever. It's like a second experience and sometimes more complete because you have the time and the distance to contemplate it. So step back a bit and take some distance to observe. Sometimes gives you a full experience. That's why I feel sad when sometimes we always say, I don't have time to read or I don't have time to watch movies or whatever, because that little thing we call reality takes too much time. Because the reality, I would say, is that unless we actually watch films or read books or listen to music, we are not living our lives.
We are going to be talking to Andres Neumann for the entire hour. Later, he and I are going to talk about ways in which this whole question of talking to ourselves surfaces in the act of writing and in the act of reading. While I was reading the book, while I was thinking about this topic, I started to wonder, what kind of clinical research is there done about the act of self-talk? And two places came up over and over again. One of them is a project at Durham University in England called Hearing the Voices, in which they are doing exactly the kind of interdisciplinary research that we're talking about right now. And the other one is the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan. We have the director of that laboratory right now, Professor Ethan Cross, is only available to us for about 15 minutes, but we're grateful to have those. So, Ethan Cross, welcome to this conversation.
Thanks for having me. Glad I can make it.
So one thing that I read as I was just going through some of the research is that in some ways the silent self-talk, the silent inner monologue that we have has some real similarities to actually speaking aloud to ourselves, that there are actually tiny muscular movements in the larynx detectable by electromyography when we're not saying anything but we're having that inner monologue that somewhat mirror what speech would be. There are also in neuroimaging areas like the left inferior frontal gyrus Broca's area, which light up just the way that they would if we were speaking aloud. So is that one of the things you're sort of looking at, is our inner monologues similarity to what happens if I'm just talking to myself in the car?
You know, not exactly. Close, though. I mean, what we've really looked at in our studies is whether there are different ways of talking to yourself and whether the language that people use to refer to themselves when they introspect, which everyone does, right? Does the way that you refer to yourself make a difference for your ability to control your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors under stress? And one of the things that we've found over and over in lots of different studies is that some people use their own name and other types of non-first-person pronouns when they think to refer to themselves when they think about it. So have you ever had the experience, for example, of making a mistake and maybe using your first name? Oh, God damn it, why did, and then plug in your name?
Yes, absolutely. I do that all the time, and I think Andres is saying he does it too.
And it turns out many people do, and so what we wanted to look at in our studies, under very tightly controlled conditions, does a very small shift going from I to using your own name, how does that impact the way people think, feel, and behave? Does it transform the way people think and psychologically represent really stressful circumstances? And motivating a lot of this work, and I overheard a little bit of your conversation just a few minutes ago when you were talking about the need for distance and taking a step back. Actually, the motivating force behind much of this work was the observation that the ability to get distance from the self when reasoning about painful experiences can be actually helpful at times. And, you know, most people have had the experience of a friend coming to them with a problem that they are just spinning over. They're ruminating, they're worried excessively, their friend can't think through the problem, they're being irrational, but they present the problem to you, right, the friend, and it's easy for you to coach them through it, right? The idea here is that you've got distance from the problem. You can think reasonably and rationally about it. And so what we wanted to look at is whether these subtle shifts in language that lead people to refer to themselves almost like they were talking or thinking about someone else, Does that allow you to think about yourself like you were another? And if so, do the benefits that come with that process also manifest? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And then, but then the question is, you know, if we can do that kind of metacognitively, in other words, if we could be aware of the way that we're thinking about ourselves, can we reprogram? Can we, if it's helpful to think and talk to ourselves in a certain way or using certain pronouns, are we capable of regulating that and reprogramming ourselves so that we do it in a way that's more helpful or affirming or less undermining?
Well, I think that's a great question. One of the things, and I don't have the answer to it. I could tell you that we're currently doing studies where we teach people how to do this in the context of essentially randomized clinical trials with appropriate control groups and so forth. So we're teaching people how to do this and then looking to see whether they do this in their daily lives over time, and if so, what the consequences of doing it is. I can tell you from our studies that our participants report anecdotally it being relatively easy to make this, to engage in the shift, to go from I to Ethan, if you will, if I was a subject in a study. So it's something that can be done easily. Of course, the question is, can you teach people to do it in the heat of the moment in daily life when they need to? And that's something we're exploring. I think people can.
You know, Andres, as he's talking, one thing that I'm thinking is what one of the things that Ethan is saying is that language is really important. That you know, that when we talk to ourselves, whether we're doing it silently or aloud, our choice of words, although it seems very reflexive, is incredibly important. I'm sure as a writer, you feel that way.
Yeah, I was fascinating listen to what he was saying because. This change from first person to third person leads us to the question that very usually we writers make to ourselves. I mean, how grammar, narrative, and psychology can have a cross point and converge in one point. And that's what the character is about, how switching from first to third, on and on, and from third to first. And that's why fiction sometimes is a deeper approach to reality. The very moment we switch from first to third, something happens with the quality of what we call reality of consciousness. And that's why fiction is not the opposite thing to reality, but simply a different door to the same reality.
Ethan Cross, there's one area where I know that there's been some research by others about this whole pronoun versus proper name thing. And that is, I mean, so first of all, I should say, I absolutely do the thing that you're describing. I do something wrong and I say, Colin, you idiot. And I say it aloud and I do it here at work and people's heads spin around. And
I should add, I mean, this is an important disclaimer. All of our studies look at engaging in this, in these linguistic shifts internally, internal monologues silently. Mm-hmm. There are potentially differences when you do it out loud, particularly with respect to social context and other people who may hear you. So we haven't looked at that. No. That's another interesting extension. But go ahead.
Okay. So, but even with this internal monologue, one of the places it gets used. We just described how it gets used, as you suggest, maybe as a self-distancing means in order to maybe achieve some kind of self-regulation, or maybe even to have a higher comfort level with having gotten as mad as you are at yourself. At least you've sort of interposed a proper name in between you and yourself. But it's also used for motivation and achievement, right? I mean, athletes do this a lot. It's like, LeBron, you can make this foul shot, you know? We see that athletes talk to themselves internally, not aloud, and they tell themselves that they can do what it is they need to do.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's funny that you mentioned LeBron. And in fact, one of the articles that we've written on this topic starts off by a quote from LeBron. Around the time, do you remember when he was on the market after his first stint with Cleveland and deciding where to go next?
Not only do I remember it, I read your article. That's why I brought up LeBron.
Okay,
but anyway, continue.
So this is a plant. Okay, great. Well, I mean, so LeBron did an ESPN special, and what he does on this special is he describes his decision-making process. How does he decide whether to leave the Cavs or go to a different team? And I quote what he says is, you know, the one thing I didn't want to do is make an emotional decision. LeBron James has got to do what is best for LeBron James. So the moment he says, I don't want to be emotional, he switches to using his own name. Fast forward a couple of years later, Malala Yousafzai, you may know her. She's I think she was the youngest person to ever receive a Nobel Peace Prize.
Mm-hmm.
She received it a couple of weeks ago. She did an interview on the Jon Stewart Show in which she recounts what she thought and felt when she discovered that she was on a hit list for to be assassinated. And she gives this interview, and what she says, and you could see this online, she goes, you know, I when I found out I was on the hit list, I was so scared and I was terrified. But then I thought to myself, Malala, you can do it. You can survive this. You can overcome this. If they come to get you, you'll hit them with a shoe. Mm. So she's switching. Both of these people are switching from I to their name under these highly arousing emotional conditions. And one of the really interesting scientific questions that we are now pursuing is, how do people learn to do this?
Mm-hmm.
We think that this is a very primitive, basic regulatory mechanism, something that people may learn at a very young age. And it's something that may kick in without awareness under highly stressful or emotional conditions, or under conditions that require regulation of the sort that you described. And so I think that's a really important question, and we're trying to answer it.
I wonder if it's going to be the same thing in each instance, though, because in the two examples that you described, in the second one, there's an error, not just an error, a reality of menace, right? There's a reality of peril. And so it almost seems as though in talking to herself by her proper name, she's almost suggesting you've got a friend. You know, that we're friends. We're actually the same person.
Right.
But I'm going to say something comforting to you as a friend.
Well, you know, and in fact, when you look at the trance, we do these kinds of thought content analyses in the laboratory. We try to see what are people thinking,
mm-hmm.
as a function of our instructions, use your name versus use the first person pronoun I. And one of the things that we see is you get people actually communicating to them, talking to themselves like they are talking to someone else, almost giving themselves a pep talk. Now, how on earth could a simple switch in language do that? The idea on the table is the following. Think about what are the contexts in which you use names and second and third person pronouns. I would argue that 99% of the time you're probably using those parts of speech when you're talking or thinking about other people,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's a very kind of automatic link. You use those names when you're thinking about others. Now, the idea here is that if you then use those parts of speech to refer to yourself, that may essentially recruit the same cognitive neural apparatus that we use to think about others to think about ourselves, and therefore transform the way we think about ourselves. In the way that these examples seem to demonstrate, and in the way that we and others are seeing in our studies.
So, and once again, that can maybe allow us to control our emotions a little bit more in a situation like that. If I'm saying, "Wow, if he runs really fast, he can get away before the hand grenade goes off," that's a little bit scary than if he runs away really fast, he can get away before the hand grenade goes off. Maybe I have enough distance there to control my emotions a little bit. Might even be an evolutionarily adaptive strategy to be able to think about myself in the third person that way.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Well, Ethan Cross, thank you so much for joining us. I know you only have 15 minutes, and we were very glad to get those 15 minutes. It's exciting to know this kind of research is being done. And you know what? Let me just ask you one more question. And it may not even be anywhere in the research that you do. But does it seem to you, because this sets up what I want to talk to Andres about in the next segment, that in these inner conversations, these silent conversations, the self-talk, is there an auditory component? In other words, do people feel as though they are in the silence of their brains hearing something?
We have some pilot data to suggest that they in fact do. So there is a sensory component to all of this. I think your intuition is correct.
All right. Thanks so much for talking to us. That's Ethan Cross. He is the director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory. I think I should send everybody I know to the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory, starting with my son, at the University of Michigan. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with a lot more of Andres Neumann, a lot more talking about talking to ourselves, both the novel and the phenomenon itself.
talking to myself, what a fool I seem to be. Telling off myself, yelling at myself, what is going on with me? My heart is beating like something crazy. My mind is somewhat hazy. It's what you do to me.
All right, we're talking about talking to ourselves. And talking to ourselves is the title of a new novel by Andreas Neumann. It has three characters, three different narrators. Each one talks to him or herself in a different way. There's a little boy who talks internally. He has an internal dialogue or a monologue he's conducting with himself as he processes what's happening to him. There's a father who's very ill, and he is speaking aloud, kind of recording his thoughts as they come out of his mouth. And then the most literary of the three characters is the mother, Elena. She is, by disposition, a reader and a writer. And both of those things become important within the world of the novel. And I wanted to spend some of this segment talking about both reading and writing and how what they have to do with talking to ourselves. So, Andreas Neumann, let's begin with reading. You know, there actually is, I mentioned before, at Durham University, a project called Hearing the Voice. And this fall, they conducted a survey in collaboration with the Edinburgh International Book Festival to explore the way readers imagine, hear, or even interact with the voices of characters in stories. And I think that's true when we read. I'm thinking of Elena as she reads, but all of us, as we read, we begin to build auditory portraits of both the voice of the narrator and any of the voices that are in the fiction. And I'm wondering, as a writer or as a reader, whether you notice that we actually do begin to hear the voices of what we read.
Yeah, totally. First of all, I would like to say that I loved the beat of the song you played a few minutes before about talking to ourselves, mm-hmm. and it reminded me an old American song which began, "I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter,
yeah.
and make believe it came from you." And that song reminded me something that Elena does when reading Olga Knipper's letters. Olga Knipper was the widow of Chekhov, the great Russian writer. Mm-hmm. They were a marriage, a peaceful marriage, I would say. They were always far away from each other. They lived in different cities, and they were very used to write exchange letters, and therefore reading the other. And when Chekhov died, Olga Knipper kept on, very movingly, writing letters to her husband after he died. And when Elena reads this, she says, "Well, I have a lot of things to say, and even a lot of things to ask you." Because the voice of the other person remains in our consciousness, regardless that person is living or not. And when we do read, something similar happens, because we are actually hearing the voice of someone else that could have died a century ago. And that's a sort of a miracle we not always think about.
I think that's right. And I think that we do have this rich auditory inner landscape that gets activated by reading. I have a very primitive and childlike version of that from my own life. And I don't know whether it resonates with a childhood in Argentina or in Spain. But here we have a comic strip called Peanuts that has Charlie Brown and Snoopy and Linus and all these characters. And at a certain point, and I read it very faithfully as a child. And when they made the animated version of it, they made a television version of it. Obviously, they had these voice actors doing the voices of these characters, and it was very jarring. And I thought to myself, "Wrong! This is all wrong," which meant that without ever having heard a sound wave touch my eardrum, I had constructed this auditory landscape of how everybody sounded. And I knew, and I think we do that with other characters too. That their sounds are in our head more than we know.
Yeah, that's very important to remark, because obviously we read with our eyes, but we read with our ears too. Reading aloud is something we learn before learning actually to how to read, because our parents or our teachers or whoever do read aloud for us. So the sound of a voice and a silent conversation, which could be the reading, are very, very linked. So when I write, and the same goes for when I read, I always hear a voice. Sometimes when it's not clear, as a radio that's not switched on properly, if I don't listen to the voice clearly, I cannot keep on reading, as if the syntax and the sound would go forward at the same time.
And now let's talk about that act of writing, because it's one of the things that surfaces for Elena, who is a dedicated writer of journals. And so one of the things that I think she struggles with is if you're writing something just for yourself to read, you're writing a journal, it's just for you. So one of the things that you're doing, obviously, therefore, is talking to yourself. And when you write something down, does it have more truth and authority as a result of it? Is there a difference between thinking, I don't desire my husband anymore, or writing it down on a page? When you write it down on a page, is it a bigger act of betrayal to have done it? Is there a way in which it's more true as a result of having been written down by you? This seems to be something that's on her mind, and I assume it's on your mind too.
Yeah, well, firstly, I would say that for Elena, reading and writing are parts of the same process. In one bit, she writes, when a book tells me something I was trying to say, I feel the right to appropriate its words as if they had once belonged to me and they were taking them back. And she's an underliner. She underlines books. I'm sure many of us do that, talking to ourselves and underlining books, two very good problems to have, and or vicious. Vices, you say? Yeah, vices. Two vices of mine, underlining books and talking to myself. And when you underline a book, you're already changing it and rewriting it. So Elena, as a result of reading, starts writing. And I think that she writes in order to put words to her silences. Sometimes we write because we wouldn't dare to say the same things to someone else. And in this case, she's writing everything that caretakers have always felt or thought, but haven't dared to admit or to say it to the others. Because Elena is like a Lady Jekyll and Hyde, Dr. Jekyll and Lady Hyde of the caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
There's the bright part, give yourself to other person, to give love and protect and feeling that you're loving deeply. But at the same time, there is a dark part. You know, the fears, the resentment, the guilt of surviving, the guilt of anticipating the grief and this classical doubt. Should I anticipate loss? Am I losing twice this person because of my anticipation? Or perhaps I need to anticipate the loss because otherwise I won't be able to resist it when it happens. And all these problems are very rarely expressed aloud, because the caretaker thinks that there is another person already suffering and you don't have the right to express your own conflict. So Elena keeps runs a diary in which she writes all these kind of problems that are very rarely talked to others when taking care of someone.
You know, and it's a good argument in favor of talking to yourself or writing to yourself, because in fact it's the way in which we do process reality. If I'm thinking to myself, Or I think my father is dying. I almost have no way of dealing with that. If I stand in the middle of a field all by myself and say aloud, I think my father is dying, that's almost the first step towards dealing with it. Or if I sit down with my journal and write, I think my father is dying, I've begun to deal with it. There's a fourth character in your novel. He's a doctor. He's having this rather vivid sexual affair with Elena, the caretaker. And one thing that he says is, and I think this is a physical version of talking to ourselves, he says, you know, we should look at ourselves in the mirror, and we should look at our bodies, and we should look at all the things that are going wrong with our bodies, if we're getting fatter, or our knees are sagging, or, you know, whatever it is that time is doing to our bodies. Rather than stuffing it to the back of our consciousness, we should bring it to the front of our consciousness, look at it, ponder it, make it real to ourselves. And in a way, I think what he's saying is a different kind of talking to ourselves, but one that, once again, allows us to begin to accept something that's difficult.
Yeah, because silences and euphemisms are in the center of our education, our family education. And regarding death, particularly, we live in a society that is constantly talking about beauty, perfection, happiness, and then pain or dark part of reality begins to be like forbidden in a way. And you know, Elena finds, because she does a sort of research on loss and grief, so she begins to reread all the books she knows about the subject, and she finds a book by a British sociologist, Geoffrey Gorer, who was the first one, the pioneer in the research of grief. And he said something to me particularly enlightening and particularly revealing. He said that prudishness didn't disappear in the 20th century, but just moved. That the prudishness and the taboo, which was focused on sex and sexual desire in the 19th century, had just moved in the 20th century to the grief and the death. That along with, and thankfully it happened, along with the development of medical science and as soon as the science could save more lives, at the same time, we lost capacity to face death and how death went out from the houses, for example, and moved to hospitals. And how when we give our ill people to the hospitals, we don't only transfer the medical responsibility, but as well we lose the emotional capacity to face it. And Gorer said that's why there is something in common between, he said, masturbation and grief. Those are two things that happen secretly and with a certain degree of guilt, he said. Mm. And when Elena reads this, she understands that there is a sort of dark pleasure in finding this out.
We're going to take a break here in just a second, and because there's so much more to cover and our time is limited. I did want to quickly just say that as I was reading the book and thinking about this, and as I said, I did as much reading as I could in the clinical literature. So there's this whole area, Andreas Neumann, which you may or may not know about. It's called neuro-linguistic programming, and it's either a fad, a passing fancy in the world of therapy, or the thing that's really going to help all kinds of people. It depends on who you believe. But they actually, interestingly, some of the practitioners of this NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, they do advocate locating those thoughts that you have, the thing that you're saying to yourself internally, and writing it down and then subtly transforming it. So an example would be that you are saying to yourself, I am such a mess. So you write that down, and then you write, I am such a mess with a question mark, like really? And then you write, I was such a mess. And then you write, I was such a mess, but. And then the last step, going back to what Ethan was saying, you write, he was such a mess, but. And that in contemplating all of those sentences and kind of, once again, kind of owning each one of them and looking at it for what it is, you might be able to reprogram your inner thoughts about yourself. I'm just going to let that idea hang in the air for a moment because we do have to take a break and there's some things I want to cover when we come back. We're talking about talking to ourselves. We'll be back after this.
Talk to myself. Yeah, you do all the time. You're just saying that to undermine me in front of all these people. I'm sorry you had to hear that. Today's show was produced by intern John Francois, Betsy Kaplan, and me. Our other interns today are Nia Tyler and Colleen Mason. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Michael Keaton. For show pages, articles, and audio of the Faith Middleton Show staff saying, "I am the Eggman, they are the Eggmen," when they think no one is listening, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, what happens when every impulse we have is instantly gratified? And now, back to Colin.
I'm talking to acclaimed novelist Andres Neumann about his novel, Talking to Ourselves. Let me just quickly, speaking of those tweets, and you may tweet to us at WNPR Colin. Harriet, I believe this is our own Harriet Jones tweets. Ha! Well, I was literally talking out loud to myself in the car when the show came on. And Jonathan tweets, "Great show today. We can even reparent if we didn't have the privilege of internalizing the voice of a supportive parent." So he's basically saying, talk to yourself in the voice of the supportive parent that perhaps you did not have. And Joe Viscondi tweets back to us about where we asked, "Where do you talk to yourself?" And he says, "In the voting booth." Ha, ha, ha. All right. So our number is 860-275-7266 as you want to chime in, if you want to chime in. Andres Neumann, since I was just reading tweets, let me tell you about something else I thought about reading your book, which is that the little boy, Leto, has an electronic digital world that he also inhabits. So he's inhabiting this crumbling world of his parents and their lives and the sickness of his father and everything that his mother is going through. But he also likes the internet. He plays games on a phone and he searches for friends in, that he already knows in chat rooms. And so once again, you know, the title Talking to Ourselves becomes possibly ironic or interesting in this way, right? That there is a new generation that, I mean, talking to ourselves is ordinarily a very internal thing, but I think this new generation may externalize some of what used to be internal because it's so easy to get there into the digital universe and talk.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. Maybe those processes that were already working now are visible or listenable, hearable. I think that's partly right, but at the same time, though, that technology, those devices, as well allow the boys, the children, to be alone more time, spending more time alone. So it's like a double-edged mechanism. There's more communication, but at the same time, you're doing the things yourself more time too. So I would say that loneliness and communication are more acute, more stronger with those devices. And there is a funny bit when Leto sends messages to her mother with this strange orthography, with those abbreviations and everything. And his mother is she's a teacher of language. Gets really mad with this and sometimes can't understand those messages. And she asks to herself whether she's getting old because she's a teacher of language and is not able to read his child's messages, her child's messages.
Yes, I love that. And his messages are especially compact and free of vowels and things like that.
I had a hard time writing them. I had to do a research, you know, to learn how to write words with only one or two letters.
I wanted to, we have, I think, enough time to, at least in brief, talk about lies versus the truth, which is, first of all, a constant source of intrigue for any novelist. And here, you know, in the context of talking to ourselves, it's something that Mario talks about at some length at one point. But in the context of talking to ourselves, you would think that talking to ourselves would be our best opportunity to be truthful. You know, what incentive do we have to tell ourselves something that's not true? The other hand, the history of psychotherapy suggests that that may not be the case, that we may have an incentive to lie to ourselves, either to tell ourselves a destructive lie, like I'm a mess, I'm no good, or a comforting lie, like this isn't really happening. As you looked at that question of internal dialogue and truth and lies, I don't know, what kinds of phenomena emerged for you?
Well, as for Mario, I think he just wants to die lucidly, facing the truth. That's his dignity. He cannot save his life, but he can choose at least the terms of his own death. And quite frequently, we do lie to the others because we think we are protecting them. That's the novel. That's one very important topic for the novel: how the doctors. Doctors tell lies to the patients because they think it will be easier for them to lie them or not to tell them the whole truth. How caretakers lie to the ill people because they think they will protect them. How the ill themselves, the ill people themselves, sometimes don't tell the truth to the caretakers because they think that the caretakers have enough hard times taking care of them. And how, finally, parents don't tell the truth to the children because they think that that way it will be easier for them. But interestingly enough, I think that this overprotection, this keeping children from pain, make them therefore unable to face it. So the novel explores all the paradoxes and contradictions implied in the fact of silencing or not telling the truth with a supposed aim of protecting our beloved ones.
Do you think it's also the case, in the case of Elena, the one who writes journals, that you can tell yourself a lie in your head more easily than you can write a lie down on paper? Does the act of having, when you're talking to yourself in your head, you might be able to say, this isn't a big thing, or this is no problem, or I'm not really doing anything wrong. But the act of writing it down on paper obliges you to hold yourself to a greater standard of truth. Does that seem right to you?
Absolutely. I think it's very difficult to lie to yourself by writing, because when you write, you pay more attention to your words and to the nuances, and it's easier to see your own lies, because most of the times we lie to ourselves without realizing. It's not that simple as saying, I'm going to lie myself, because truth is too hard to face. No, the problem is that we do believe our own lies, and by reading or writing, we can have a second or third thought to our own lies. And that's why Elena seems to be a perfect mother, a perfect caretaker, a perfect wife, but on her diary, you find out the complex and dark truth, and it's that she's full of mistakes, she's full of regrets, she's full of hidden corners. Therefore, she's a human being.
That's a perfect place for us to end. It's also the place where we have to end, whether we want to or not. So, Andres Neumann, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a fascinating conversation.
It's been a pleasure for me. Thank you very much, and thank you as well for tolerating my English.
Oh, your English is fabulous and far, far better than my Spanish. All right. Thanks also to John Francois, who made a special effort to organize this show for us today and spend some time with Andres Neumann's book. And thanks to everybody else who pitched in. We won't be doing the nose tomorrow. Oh, I know. We're actually going on a staff retreat. But we do have a brand new show for you with a very interesting writer named Paul Roberts about our inability to self-regulate in an era of impulse gratification.
Walk through. I'll keep talking to myself, talking about you.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and if I'm really talking to myself, then tell me the recurring dream I've been having every night since I was 8 years old. Only I would know that. You're rubbing a grilled cheese sandwich made out of jalapeno Havarti, an egg over easy, and sautéed onions all over your face. Oh my God, I do talk to myself.